Nora Vincent was curious about what it was like to be a man. So curious she spent 18 months pretending to be a guy. Vincent writes about her sociological gender-bending experiment in a book called Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. Vincent told Anne Strainchamps about her debut as her male alter ego Ned, and what was going through her mind as she entered a bowling alley disguised as a man.
Absolute terror. You know, I remember thinking, you know, that the sound of the place, you know, all the balls crashing, it's really loud, people are talking. And to me, it just seemed like a blur, a sort of a audiovisual blur. And all I could think was that I felt like I was naked standing there and everybody could see me or see through me. Because it was really the first time that I'd been in a large group of people, especially men, where I was trying to pass. And it really did feel as if everyone was aware and knew that I was there. And of course, that wasn't true, really. But then, of course, I had to sort of step over that boundary from being an observer to acting in the scene. So I just kind of stepped in and then I just realized there's no going back. You know, I was telling myself, you're a complete lunatic, but it's sort of one of those things where you realize, okay, I just have to do this. You go into automatic mode and you just become someone else and you stop thinking about what you're doing and you just do it because you know that you have to convey this convincingly enough so that people will buy it. And if you're not confident in your role, you're not going to do that well.
And what happened when you went in?
Well, they just, you know, they shook my hand and welcomed me. And that, even that, just the shaking of the hand was really remarkable to me in the sense that it was the first time I really noticed, I guess, something very different about the way, something that we do every day when we shake people's hands as a woman, when you shake a man's hand as a woman, or if you shake another woman's hand. It's just, it's a different dynamic depending on who it is and who you are.
How so? What's different when men shake hands?
Well, you know, if you see it from the outside as a woman, I've often thought that it's sort of overdone. You know, it's kind of this big swinging arc that happens often, and it's kind of really macho. It seems to be over-the-top macho. But I think with these guys, what I felt was this, and I went in expecting them to treat me like a pariah, that I was thinking it was almost like going into prison and somehow, you know, they were going to size me up and essentially crush me, when in fact it was quite the opposite. It was this rush of inclusion that you know, I suddenly tuned into this idea that I called the buddy bonding script, that, you know, men get each other in some way that is just something I'd never experienced, you know, that they just, it's an undercurrent of being male in our culture. And they were transmitting that to me, sort of saying, hey, you're one of us. And there was this presumption of goodwill that you're a good guy until you prove otherwise, which just was something I'd never experienced and didn't expect to experience.
You turned out not to be a very good bowler. How did the other men treat you?
Well, that was another thing. I thought, okay, if I can't measure up, they're going to crush me. And in fact, this was another thing, learning about male versus female competitiveness. I was really surprised to learn that they wanted me to be better. They sort of had this fatherly attitude, even men who were on other opposing teams. And this was a money league, so it wasn't that, you know, we weren't playing for nothing. It was as if they couldn't take the idea that there was a guy who was this inept, you know? And so they would take me aside and just say, okay, look, this is what you're doing wrong or whatever. And I guess I got the feeling after a while that it was that you don't want to beat a guy on a handicap, because I had this big handicap and that gave my team extra points. But it's not satisfying for men, I think, competitively to beat someone who isn't at his best. It's better to get him at his best or to compete against someone who's better than you are perhaps and then win. And then you have a sense of satisfaction. Whereas I think, you know, again, this sense of competitiveness. I've played sports all my life against other women, and I never had that sense that we were helping each other, oddly. Or, you know, and it made me think, of course, of that slogan of feminism, that sisterhood is powerful, that we had to be taught that in some way, you know, that wasn't something we seemed to already know. And I think you do hear that said sometimes in offices and so on, that somehow there's this thing that women do, you know, even after feminism, that we're not as supportive of each other as we probably should be, given that we feel that, you know, we have to help each other along, or we should feel that.
There's a scene you describe in the bowling alley where it kind of really hit you that men are so much less competitive with each other than maybe we tend to assume. It's the scene where there's a guy who's bowling who's just so much better than everybody else. And will you describe?
Yeah, well, and that was another moment where I think I tuned into this undercurrent of a kind of a connection that men have with each other. And I witnessed this in other ways, that there's a kind of a silent communication And I think this happens too when men watch football, or when they, you know, when they, that they get a vicarious thrill out of watching the superior athleticism of another male. It was hard for me to understand going in, but, you know, being in the bowling alley, this guy was bowling a perfect game. And everybody somehow seemed to be aware of it increasingly as he went along to the 10th frame. And then in the 10th frame, you bowl three separate times to make sure, and if you hit a strike every time, then you have a perfect score. And when it came to that 10th frame, everybody just sat down and stood back and let him do his thing. And I, of course, was completely out of the loop on this and didn't know why everyone had stopped. And then it suddenly occurred to me, and I looked over and I thought, wow, you know, it was as if somebody had orchestrated it, but of course nobody had. And it just felt, again, like a remarkable moment. It stuck out to me as something that probably wouldn't have happened among women.
What did the men talk about when they're just hanging out with each other? Isn't this what women really want to know? What are the guys really talking about when we're not there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose a lot of it is what you would expect, in the sense that, you know, you do talk about the sports that have gone on, say, over the weekend. This was a Monday night league, so you would talk about that. But again, there were surprises. You know, they all talked about their wives in very reverential terms, which was interesting, you know, that they would feel that and communicate it openly. And I guess a lot of people probably figure that men are sitting around belly aching about their wives all the time, which I'm sure some of them do, but in this case they didn't. But they also talked about, you know, for example, going on vacation and wanting to go to strip bars. And so it was sort of an interesting look at the way that, you know, I got a little bit tuned in again to another aspect of male life, and that is reconciling male sexuality with marriage and monogamy, and the ways that different men that I met tried to do that.
Well, tell me more about that.
Well, I think that's one of those things that women just probably will never understand, because I really do believe it's fueled by a chemical phenomenon. I mean, that their levels of testosterone are just fueling a sex drive, and their way of viewing sex, the very visual experience for them, very visually stimulated, and it's a very sort of visceral experience, almost, as some of them described it to me, like going to the bathroom. I mean, or having a meal, that it's like a basic need that they have to fulfill. Whereas for women, it's obviously a much more complicated, there's so much more surrounding it. It's not just a bodily function. And I think it's just very hard for women to tune into that, because we don't, you know, as I read somewhere, which is a good explanation, it's not that we're different species, we're just on different drugs. You know, we're on estrogen and they're on testosterone. And just as much as they can't understand PMS or whatever else estrogen might do to us, we can't understand what testosterone does to them. And so listening to men try to talk about the ways that they try to reconcile being married and yet continually having this sex drive or these fantasies, and strip bars were one way that I think a lot of people tried to chart some middle course where they could go and look at women. You know, you can't touch, so maybe you don't feel quite as guilty about doing that, but you're satisfying some of that urge.
You went along with some of the friends that you'd made in the bowling alley to some strip joints. I would imagine that would be profoundly uncomfortable as a woman, that you'd be experiencing sort of, I guess, one of the uglier sides of how men regard women, you know, the objectification, the contempt. Was it like that, not like it?
It was. I mean, I think, you know, people have said of the book that it feels like it's kind of a love letter to men, and yet, you know, I do show them at their absolute worst. And I think one of the places in which I do that is in the strip bar, because that is sort of, as I call it, the sub-basement of male sexuality. And most men, if you talk to them, will usually admit that some part of them has a toe in there, at least, if not more. And you do come smack up against the difference when you go in as a woman. You know, if I had gone in as a woman, visibly a woman to other people, it would have been a totally different dynamic. So going in as a guy, I was able to kind of be invisible and really observe these behaviors, because men wouldn't have been sort of as honest and open about what they were thinking or how they were feeling if I'd been sitting next to them as a woman at the bar. So the same with the strippers.
What did you see then that you might not have expected?
Well, I think, again, it was this startling sort of way in which it was purely a physical function devoid of emotional content. Also that it didn't appear to me to be, I mean, most of these people didn't seem to be having that much fun. They seemed to be kind of trying, I mean, part of it seemed like a dysfunctional sexuality that they were trying to come to terms with. And, you know, just watching people disappear into these booths and, you know, rub up against some woman and I guess maybe have some satisfaction, maybe not. It's, you know, I don't think all of them did. But it really feels like you're almost in a slaughterhouse or something. You know, it just feels to a woman's sexuality, every pretense is stripped away. There's absolutely no preamble, no flirtation, nothing that I think, nothing emotional that a woman could connect to that I think turns women on. So it's really alienating.
And you still, in that situation, had to pass as a man. Did that mean you had to take part?
Yeah, I had lap dances. I mean, I felt that I wanted to know, you know, I wanted to get as close to the experience as I could. And that, too, I remember just, you know, freezing, my body just going absolutely limp and just feeling almost like I was being molested. It was just very strange to have this person sitting on your lap, gyrating on top of you. And it was just the antithesis of arousing. And I was literally putting my mind elsewhere and looking. I couldn't even look at them, really, because it just seemed so grotesque and just unpleasant.
You got pretty close to a bunch of the guys that you were spending time with. What happened when you finally came out to some of them, told them you weren't really a man?
Well, in one particular case with the bowlers, I took one of the guys that I'd gotten to know a little bit better and thought was a little bit brighter and probably more subtle. I took him out and, you know, gave him a few beers and shots and I said, you know, because you're going to need him. And it really took me basically an hour to convince him. I mean, he just would not believe me. He thought I was playing a practical joke on him. And he said, you know, if I'd thought of it, I would have done it to you, but, you know, enough's enough. And, you know, it really took me essentially in the end showing him my anatomy to really convince him. And it took him probably a couple of weeks to really get his mind around it. I mean, the way he describes it to me now, it was something that it's really a mind blower for some people. And it wasn't that he was mad or he didn't really feel duped or anything. But he did say, you know, you were my best guy friend. And now you're a woman and our friendship changed. You know, it's a good friendship, but it's a male-female friendship. It's not a male-male friendship anymore.
What changed?
Well, there are things that we talk about now. We talk much more intimately now than we did before. We have physical affection. He tells me he loves me. You know, I mean, he can tell me that now in a way. I mean, we didn't know each other well enough for him to say that then. But, you know, it's just something he never would have said to Ned. And really just revealing a lot of things about himself that I think he felt I could understand. That, as I say, you're not allowed in most male friendships. There's a wall that you hit where you're just not allowed to admit certain things emotionally.
It makes it sound like the friendship got better after you stopped being a man.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in my terms, it got better. I think for him, too, I suppose there are some things that we lost in the sense that we do exist in a way on separate sides of a divide. He will always be male and I'll always be female, and there will be some strangeness there that wouldn't exist. You know, I don't know if it's in some way that there's, it's not like it's a sexual attraction really, but it's just that there's a feeling that we are different species, you know, and that we have to sort of be careful around each other. So as much as we can enjoy these deeper conversations, there's a little bit of kind of walking on eggshells, just a little bit, you know, not entirely, but there's much more of that, I think, than there was when we were men together.
Hmm. It sounds like such a mind-bending experience, and it's sort of astonishing to think that you kept doing it for 18 months at some personal cost to yourself, we should point out. And you wound up having a nervous breakdown at the end of this.
Yeah, it was, and I certainly, it's one of those things that if I'd known that going in, of course, I would never have done it. But I'm certainly glad that I did, and I'm glad I approached it with that kind of ignorance as strength attitude.
But what was it about the whole experience, do you think, that wound up making you crack up?
Well, I think, as I described it, contravening your own gender identity, every signal that you've ever been given from birth has told you this is the creature that you are. You are a female, and this is how you are expected to behave. And I think the reason this project interested me so much is that I think gender is so central to any culture. It determines so much, and so much of it's unspoken because the cues are just learned on the fly. And it's like learning, you know, how little kids learn language. It's just very mysterious, but somehow then you speak. So we speak this language of gender. And when you cross over or you pull out this portion of your brain that has been taught to be that says you are female, you are feminine, and you slot in something else that's trying to tell you you're masculine, you're male, it really messes with your sense of self, your core sense of self, and you become very confused. I mean, I think we really are, in a way, very simple creatures, and we need our categories. And when you blur those categories, that's why I think people are so threatened by people who bend gender, because it's scary. It threatens the structure of our world that helps us to make sense of it.
Nora Vincent is the author of Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. She spoke with Anne Strange Champs.